I am Susan. I'm an alcoholic.
And
just trying to see the clock back there. My sobriety date is October 21st, 2000, and Midtown is my home group. And I'm really grateful to be here. Just like Chuck was saying, I can tell you guys for sure, every single part of my life today has been a gift of sobriety. I had nothing when I got here, and everything from the inside out that's in my life today is a direct result from continuously doing the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I know this is a design for living that really does work. Billy and Lynn, thank you so much. You guys are some of the kindest people I know, and I often actually think of you a lot when I'm in my daily life trying to be a little bit more kind than I naturally am. And I always like coming down here, and I always like meeting the people you go to meetings with. It's just very, very nice down here. It's such a good feeling, and I feel that way about my home group too, you know. It can be a little overwhelming, but I know that that overwhelmingness saved my life because I was so unsure when I got here. And you know, when I, the book talks about an alcoholic being naturally restless, irritable, and discontent. And I can look backwards and see that was the case from the beginning without any real reason for it. You know what I'm saying? Like, I am naturally wired that way. From my earliest memories, I have been uncomfortable in my skin. And, you know, when I did my original fourth step, it literally went back to kindergarten, because I can still think of kindergarten, and I had, like, crippling envy. I mean, in kindergarten, just naturally, there was no reason for me to be uncomfortable or looking at you and wanting what you had. But I'll tell you, there was a girl named Mary, and she had blonde hair and blue eyes and wore Jordache dresses. And, like, I mean, I have followed her around like a dog. I mean, and it killed me. And I'd be on the playground, and I say this because it is just naturally how I was built. You know, a boy broke his arm and was on crutches and spent like the first week trying to go around the playground kissing girls. And I remember feeling so heartbroken he didn't come after me. Like, I can just see, I can look back and I can see, for no practical, logical reason, did I ever feel comfortable enough in my skin. You know, starting in fourth grade, you know, my parents, they happened to love me. I happened to have, like, a really stable home. There was nothing to, you know, set off any kind of bad self-esteem or, like, perverse negativity. But, I mean, even back in fourth grade, I pulled my mom aside and very seriously said, I need to go to the doctor. I think I'm developing breast cancer. And I was so convincing. She took me out of school, and we went to the appointment and saw the doctor, and I got a mammogram in fourth grade. And I can't believe they did that, by the way. It's so funny. But afterwards, the doctor sat us down and was like, I just want to let you know your daughter's fine. She's just developing breasts. I mean, I thought I was developing breasts. I thought I literally had two tumors and was in hysterics about it. And that literally is the start of me searching for the answer to why I felt so bad on the inside. You know, I continued going to doctors. By seventh grade, I was having, like, complete hysterical breakdowns over book reports. And I was a good student. But, like, God forbid I got a B+. It was like the world came to an end, and I really actually couldn't deal. And in seventh grade and on, I started going into those doctors and asking for help. Why do I feel this way? You know, why can't I sleep? Why do I feel so anxious? You know, why am I breaking down? Why my mom, you know, why is she so hysterical? Why, you know, why is she so negative? Terrified of the dark. Getting in trouble constantly at school, basically for, like, nuisance level seeking attention. You know what I mean? Not being able to be one among many in the classroom, you know? And starting in seventh grade, I started getting all of my many, I've had so many diagnoses, you know what I'm saying? Some of my first ones were an anxiety disorder. Your daughter has a sleep disorder. I kept seeing these doctors, kept seeing them, because in my gut I knew that what they were telling me, like, yeah, it matched, but like I knew, like, on a very basic level that that wasn't it. Like, it's something more, it's something deeper, it's something weirder. And I kept going to see these doctors in high school, and they started telling me, I think it's depression. My mom was like, oh, that makes sense. It runs in our family. She had it, her sister, her mom, whatever. I tried every brand of therapy. In high school, I had my mom and dad and I with crayons at one point, just my mom and I. I could just tell on the inside, again, for no apparent reason, I just saw myself kind of getting, like, pickled, like, more and more sarcastic, more and more negative, and more uncomfortable. And I took my first drink when I was just about to graduate high school. And I had kind of judged my friends throughout high school, thinking, they need to drink in order to get along in social situations. And one night at a party at my friend's house, I just said, I don't know why, but I was like, whatever, I'm just going to try it. And it was a six-pack of Zima. And we were at a house party, and, the parents weren't home. And, I just had the best time at that party. It was such a black and white difference after I had a couple of those drinks in me. But it was the very same place. And I was the very same person, but all of a sudden I was having a completely different experience in that same group of people. And I think this sounds kind of silly, I guess, but if you drank like me, like, you know what I mean. It was like I drank a magical potion. I mean, that is how profound the effect of alcohol is on me, and still would be today. And that is literally why I still have to be so rigorous in what I do. Alcohol never stopped working for me. I'm 10 years sober, and if somebody describes their liquor in too great of detail from the podium, I will still salivate. I still regularly have drinking dreams. When I'm off the beam, if I'm tending to a resentment or I've got a lot of fear going on, I can literally still feel that crush in my chest for the relief I know liquor would bring like that. That's me. That effect produced by alcohol was so immediate and so magical that I chased it and really disregarded every single consequence that came my way. And if you're, like a woman, the big book talks about women in particular go beyond recall really quickly. And that is my story. I drank for 5 years, which might sound like a short amount of time, but I can't tell you how destroyed I was by the end of those 5 years. I blacked out the second time I ever drank. And I blacked out, I would tell you, 99% of every time I ever drank. So, like, from the get-go, I never had any idea that that wasn't normal. And I never had any idea that perhaps a reasonable, mentally well person would have that happen and be scared and be like, I don't like that. That's not safe. I had none of that. When I got to college, I had drank two times, I guess, before I got to college, and I had that blackout that second time. And when I got to college, my parents were so loving and so protective, but when I got there, it was game on. And I literally erupted into my alcoholism. And from the very start of my college career, I was drinking six times a night. By the end of the 5 years of my drinking, I was drinking every day. So it's not that great of a contrast. What happened was, I had been drinking probably about, it couldn't have been more than 3 weeks into college, and I had suffered one of my worst consequences. I went to a school that was very small. My entire school had 1,600 people in it. We all knew each other's faces. it was a very small campus, and that night I went into a blackout like I always did with another gentleman. We both went into a blackout in an extremely public place in a very compromising sexual situation. It ended up that night, everyone was like, you know, people were like running through the dorms, grab your cameras, come down, take pictures. You know, the whole school had taken all these photographs. And I honestly, this sounds funny, but I am so grateful this was like before the day of like Facebook and, I'm not like, I know that sounds funny, but like, I was beyond mortified at that. But like, honestly, I don't think those pictures ever lived beyond school. It wasn't like the day of the internet, you know, it was before that. But, so that night, like, you know, everyone got their cameras out. The man was covered in, shaving foam head to toe. A friend, I don't know, I guess, you know, a guy slung me over his shoulder after the pictures were all taken and deposited me in a bed. You know, that gentleman ended up in like alcohol classes because he was allowed to pass out in that situation, and somebody, you know, non-student came across him in the morning and he was taking alcohol classes, and I felt so bad for him, like, poor dude, like that, you know. And I had no recollection at all of the night, but it was like many of my mornings where I woke up, first of all, I still, you know, don't know how this happened, but again, this is like any given night for me in those 5 years. I woke up in my bed the next, you know, early afternoon, and I was wearing my ballet leotard and tights. I know I did not go out that night in my leotard. So that was like I'm like, okay. And that feeling of complete dread in my stomach, what happened? I have no idea, as usual. And again, that in and of itself wasn't alarming, but I was like, God, you know, and I had to get the night narrated to me. And it was really like a bad movie. Like, I went into my good friend's dorm room, and literally everyone in there just went dead silent. And one of them stood up, and I was like, and I knew, just like I always did when this happened, when I came to and people went quiet, or and somebody walked me outside and explained to me what had happened. And, you know, like, during college, my nickname from that night could have been the name of a porn movie. It was the most disgusting, degrading nickname you'd ever had. And I would for the rest of those 4 years, you know, hear like incoming freshmen telling the story to each other in the line at the diner, not knowing like it was me standing right behind them. You know what I mean? Those pictures were circulating forever. I got like collages of them for Valentine's Day. And the problem was that was how I lived. I chose the effect of alcohol over consequences like that 6 out of 7 nights a week every time I drank. And one of my nicer nicknames was Shoeless Sue. I mean, that was my reputation. And I was, obviously, as we are, I couldn't tell the truth from the false. I was full flight from reality. And in my mind, I was like, I heard the way people talked about me, you know. After that night, my good friend, who we had started, you know, becoming really best friends at college, basically broke up with me because she didn't know how to handle me. And I remember, and again, this is weeks into my drinking, she really upset me by breaking up with me. And I said, you know, I don't drink out of hand. And I, for myself, said, well, I'm just not going to drink for a month and show her. Not that she was interested or cared. I mean, she really left me after that night. But that was my first attempt to control my liquor consumption. Like, hey, I'll show you guys. I'm not going to drink for a month. And I made it through 2 of the most painful college weekends of my life. And I made it through that period of time, which I realized in sobriety, by smoking pot 24/7. And then finally, at the start of that second weekend, I was like, I chose to go back to drinking. I do not have to live like this. This is unbearable. Why does anyone have to do this? I have shown myself I do not need to drink, and I am not going to live this way. And I chose to go back to drinking. And in my mind, I remember very quietly thinking, you know, everyone's wrong about me. I'm a virgin. How can they be? I mean, it's like, it's so crazy. I was hanging on to that one technical fact But like day in and day out, I was living like an insane, crazy animal, wondering why everybody was treating me as they did and talking about me like they did. And I think I brought water up here. Oh, yes. Thank you. Sorry. But so I went through college, and my grades were not great, obviously. But I did graduate. And again, you know, drinking 6 out of 7 nights a week, consequences coming at me, as you know, every single night. I did a geographic. I went to California right after I graduated. I thought, I'm going to live someplace where there's a palm tree in my backyard. It'll be warmer and softer and kinder. The people are sunnier out there. It's going to be better. But just like you're saying, I brought my own drunk self with me. And that year out there was my worst year. Living on my own with a woman who is like, she was a bridesmaid at my wedding, you know, 5 years ago. She is one of the kindest, nicest women I've ever met in my life, just naturally so. Not like us, where we have to, like, toil at it and go against ourselves. She just, like, came out of the womb this way. But she lived with me out there for that year, and I physically assaulted her. I tried to sexually assault her. I emotionally, like, pretty much beat her up. I mean, emotionally, even every day. She felt like, she got sick, too, from living with me under my influence. I mean, her spirit was basically crushed over that year. And she didn't know how to handle me and had been talking to her parents. She didn't know what to do. And that year, I remember because of the way we lived and our irresponsibility, she called me New Year's Day of that year, hysterically crying, saying, "Our apartment has exploded. It's burned up. It exploded out the bay windows. Everything's smoldering on the street. You've got to come home." And I came home. Hannah was with my boyfriend, and Sarah was there, and just like, you know, like any reasonable, I think, person might be, just crying, not knowing what to do. I mean, there was police tape on the street, and literally our belongings was smoldering, had to come out. You know, we went in the apartment later. The fire was so strong, it had, like, literally melted the thermostat, the metal thermostat, down the wall like it was, I mean, you know, Play-Doh or something. And that was because we had lived irresponsibly and had our mattresses, like, pressed flush up against the heater, and I mean, I had left all my drug stuff out, and so the firemen were in there, pictures were taken of the way we were living and in the areas that were less damaged, of the drug paraphernalia and everything. All of our belongings were ruined, and I had a trash bag of smoke-damaged clothing. And when I got there, I kind of looked through it, walked through it, and I remember thinking about Sarah, "You are so weak." And I left her there, and I told my boyfriend, I said, "Take me to the bar." And in my mind, and I think God gives us some memory bubbles sometimes, because there's no reason I should remember word for word this thought, but in my mind, literally, I thought, "I am so going to drink for free tonight. No one's going to believe this." And just went on my way. Went directly to a bar and drank sake all afternoon and all night for free. I was right, you know, and then just, you know, moved into my boyfriend's room. And that year, that's where I hit that jumping off place where it says, you know, I couldn't imagine my life with alcohol or without alcohol anymore. And I really did wish for the end. And I started finding myself doing things like going across the street and intentionally not looking either way, hoping to get it taken care of in that manner. Like, "Will something just please take care of this for me? I'm too much of a coward to really do it myself, but I would try to put myself in positions where it might be taken care of for me." And I knew, like, that guy in the Big Book, he's my favorite, the guy who, like, drags himself into the abandoned barn to die, I love him. That is how I felt on the inside right before I landed in AA. I knew, like an animal knows, like before they go and drag themselves into the bushes to die, I knew I was dying. I still had no idea what the problem was, though. And that's why I know it is God's plan that I'm here. I can't believe that I found Alcoholics Anonymous. This entire time when I was hitting that bottom for that year, I started drinking every day. From the moment I woke up to the moment I passed out, I was not sober. And just like Chuck said, like there was some, I did drugs as well to help me to do that and to kind of, I guess, show up at this job. And all that year, though, knowing I was dying, I got really aggressive in trying to figure out what was wrong with me. I started going back to the therapist again, back to church again. I had gotten all of these books. Like, I had a really thick manual, like this thick on, like, white magic. Like, I thought if I could find the right crystal or something, it would bring me healing power. I had been looking into going away to a weekend-long juice cleanse. Again, just knew none of this was right. None of the therapists could really tell me anything that seemed to hit the mark. But one woman pretty much saved my life. And I, in my rounds, trying to figure out my medications, and she just looked at me. I tried her. She was new. Basically, you know, she looked at me. She said, "I can't help you. I'm going to make you an appointment at the rehab at downtown tomorrow morning." And I looked at her like she had five heads. I was like, you are literally not hearing what I am telling you. I am depressed. I don't know why you're bringing alcohol into the picture here. Like, I really thought like she was crazy. Like, what is wrong with you? What? And again, this shows you how my thinking was. When she asked me about my drinking, I actually greatly minimized it. And I was still outraged, like a complete deluded crazy person. I was still outraged at her for suggesting this. But I went home that night outraged, stole some books and like out of spite and like went home. And the idea of going to rehab sat with me overnight. And I thought, oh my God, you know what? I could get 2 weeks off of work. And that really rang true in my bones, because that I can tell you, I had no language. Like the words I'm telling you guys now, it's like from reading the Big Book for 10 years. You know what I'm saying? Like, I had no way to describe what was going on with me. The only word I had was tired. Like, I need help. I am so tired, like in my bones, dog tired. I can't go on anymore. I really do want to die. What's wrong with me? And I gave in and went to my first rehab because I could take a 2 week break. And I still had no inclination that that would have anything to do with me actually recovering. But I thought I needed that rest. And so I did go. And, sorry, I have a hair in my mouth. Oh, okay. Got it. It's distracting. So I started going to this rehab, and again, I was, like, scared they wouldn't let me in, you know, and that was not a problem. We just have no clear perception of ourselves, you know what I mean? Like, and they required us to be going to meetings. Long story short, I couldn't stay stopped. That was not my sobriety date. This is my third sobriety date. I did go to that rehab. I did try to stop drinking. I kept going to mental outpatient. Like, this is kind of odd. I don't know how usual this is. I was certain I was mentally ill before I got here, but I had no idea what an alcoholic was. So that was kind of odd. So while I was going to rehab, I was going to, like, outpatient mental problem outpatient. I don't even know how to describe it. It was just other crazy people. And the deal was, if you're new and you're wondering, like, how does this work? It wasn't working for me because I wasn't doing it. I was going to a meeting here or there. And I was still going to my favorite dirty, sordid places, putting my forearms up on the sticky bars, feeling it on my arms, smelling in the air, ordering, like, Sprite on the rocks, thinking I'm cute, going to hang out in the bathroom. I used to love hanging out in the bathroom in clubs and, like, doing girls' makeup and just holding court in the bathroom of these gross places. I hadn't changed anything at all. I had no sponsor. This is going to sound weird. I didn't know there were 12 steps. I'd never heard of a home group. I was so on the fringe there, but I thought, I'm going to a meeting sometimes, and I tried to stop drinking. Why isn't everything coming together? And that was my first thing where I was like, this is my last stop. Like, I have tried. My parents had money enough to fund me in every attempt to get well and to research what's wrong with me. You know what I'm saying? Like, I knew I had been to every brand of, like, treatment and doctor and everything. And I'm like, this AA thing is like, if this doesn't work, I knew very quietly and undramatically I was going to kill myself. Because I knew, like, I didn't want to do that to my parents. So I kept trying to hold off and hold off. And I knew if AA didn't work, I knew to my innermost self, I had tried everything that there was, and I was just going to take my life, and I wouldn't feel bad about it. And I don't really remember the order of things, kind of like what you were saying, you know, because there was still so much drinking in there. But basically two things happened. One was, and I've been drunk in many a meeting, you know, so just saying, there's nothing wrong with that. And really. And I like it when I smell alcohol in a meeting. I'm like, I'm home. These are my people. I am right where I need to be. You know, I can't ever get too far away from that, you know. But two things happened. One was drunk in a meeting, you know, full makeup, high heels, complete, like, tramp clothes on in the corner, just drunk as hell. And you know, like in a pile in the back pew. But this woman, I swear to God, was standing up here like I am. And she was, I mean, I'll never forget this woman. She had a headband on. Her hair was washed. It had a haircut. She had on a skirt and a nice, respectable shirt and nice shoes. And was looking everyone in the eye with total ease. Like, you know the people in Alcoholics Anonymous who really have a program. To me, they shine from the inside out. Like, you can't fake it. You know, when I look around, I can see the people who do this and are safe and stable in their sobriety. They have, like, a light from the inside out. And even in my literal drunken stupor pile in the corner, this woman was a beacon to me. And the craziest thing was, that wasn't why she was a beacon, because of how she looked. You know what I'm saying? It was what she was saying. She said nearly word for word, like, as if it was nothing, almost the identical, most humiliating story of my drinking and how that was one of the things that really shook her up and got her to think twice about the way she drank. And there was no echo of shame, and she just looked like this wholesome, stable, completely adapted citizen up there with a smile on her face and kind eyes just up there telling the story, where I was like, oh my God, me too. Me too. How do you look like, not like superficial, but how are you like that? With that, you know, it just didn't match. She drank like I drank, but she looked like that with some other kind of stability coming from the inside out. She was not like me on a cliff, you know, wishing for the end. She was up there uncomfortable. And it was that identification that I could not find in any other doctor or anyone with a white lab coat or even my well-meaning and loving parents. It was that identification when, for the first time in my life ever, I found somebody. It was like getting shot through the heart with an arrow. Oh my God. Like, for the first time, I was 23 when I got sober. For the first time ever, like a shock of cold water, hearing somebody describe what my problem was. I've been searching since fourth grade for somebody to describe what was wrong with me, and there this woman was doing it. I mean, that was such a God moment. I couldn't help it. I ran up to her after the meeting, and I asked her to be my sponsor. Nothing came of it. We watched Xena one time together. Again, nothing came of it. I wasn't at my bottom. I kept going. I kept going deeper and deeper, darker and darker. I was not willing, you know. I was not doing the 12 steps with a sponsor, so I was not getting that psychic change that's sufficient enough to keep me from drinking again. So one day, driving to work, I knew if I was going to drive over the Bay Bridge, and it was so dead calm, and that's why I knew it was something real, I was going to drive off the bridge. And so instead of driving over the Bay Bridge, I drove back downtown to that rehab. I didn't know where else to go and got my counselor there. I just walked in, you know, it was like, it's me. I parked illegally out front and I was like, can I talk to you? I sat down. I told her what I just told you. And she said, okay, you just sit tight right there. And that was the first time an ambulance came to take me away. And that was my first entry into a mental hospital. And I went in and out of mental hospitals a couple of times. My parents got a phone call. I mean, they had only seen glimpses of my drinking. I still will never be able to. I still feel awfully about that, even though our relationships have transformed. But like my mom came in between one of those mental hospital stays, and she found me in the corner with like a butcher knife, she kind of shoved into my stomach, and me just begging her, please put me back in, please put me back in. I don't know, I can't do this. Me just not drinking, but without taking the actions of this program, all it did was absolutely rocket my feelings of insanity. I can't just not drink. That's a heavy drinker. Like the Big Book describes, a heavy drinker, given sufficient reason, might be able to stop or moderate. That is not me. I have a spiritual malady. When I stop drinking, I'm still left with my spiritual malady. And the only solution I found today, which thank God I have, is continuously, even stomping my feet, doing the actions of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I didn't know that then. So I just knew, I guess I'm going to be medicated and locked up for the rest of my life. I didn't know I hadn't really done Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was moved back home to live in a mental hospital. Like, address changed, done, you're done. This is my new home. And the same thing happened that happened to me with that woman, where in one of my days there, this man came to talk to us, and he was an alcoholic. He wasn't a doctor. And he shared his story. And he was talking at the front of the room, and he said that after this one night of drinking, he'll never forget that he woke up, he had no idea where he was, and he went to the window to try to orient himself, and he saw cacti, I don't know. And he saw cactuses and was like, this is really not good. He did not begin drinking in a region where cactuses grew. And again, right there, I was like, again, you know what I'm saying? It's like that relief. Like, it's like one, oh God, I will just never forget it. Like, again, like, oh my God, I have to talk to you. I have to talk to you. That's it. That's it. You know, I mean, and I'm living in this mental hospital, living day in and day out with people who have grave, grave mental illnesses. And I feel gravely mentally ill, but not in the manner that these folks are. And again, I'm like, this is everyone's last stop on the block. There's no other place to go but living in a mental hospital. I mean, I really was like out of sorts. Like, I'm here. I'm living here. These people around me, yes, I can tell they are mentally ill, but not the same way I am. Can anyone tell me what's wrong with me? You know what I'm saying? And when that man said that out loud, again, I just attacked him after the meeting. I said, what is this? What is this? You know? And he said, you need to go to another meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was like, but I've been. You know? And he just said, look, just do me a favor. He said, when you graduate to a day patient, which I didn't know when that was going to happen. There was no talk of that. I mean, I'd been in there for months and months, and there was no whisper about graduation of any sort. But he did say, he said, there will come a day, and he's like, and that's what you've got to shoot for. You have got to shoot for becoming a day patient. That is your hope. It's not in here. And he said, I want you to go to this meeting. And he gave me the name of the meeting. We have this meeting. It's actually called Choir. For no reason. But I remember, I'm like, God, we should change the name of that meeting because I can't sing. And so when the day came that I did graduate, I was like really hesitant to go. I was like, I can't sing at all, like not even just like a little. And so I actually dragged my feet to going to this meeting anyway. But many, many months later, I did graduate to that day program, and I eventually did meet up with my home group's huge. It's like 400 people. And there's a lot of good going on in that home group. And I eventually met up with the masses that are my home group, finally. And I'll tell you, the first time I walked in that room, again, I was 23. I had been to a meeting here or there, but I had never seen people my age in that number. And the other thing was, just like that woman had been, I swear to God, you all looked carbonated to me. I mean, I was looking at a room of hundreds of people my age who were like, just, I mean, I remember thinking of those Country Time Lemonade commercials with the sun coming through in little dapples and people like skipping on the like dock and like jumping into the lake and that everyone's so happy and drinking lemonade. And it was totally shocking to me. I was like still in like complete black clothing, surly, dirty, unshowered, you know. But I was absolutely like, what is going on here? I must know. It was that attraction. It was like, I must know. What is happening here? Like, you guys were a little crazed to me, which I am now too. When I see somebody, I'm like, I don't think I've met you before. I am really glad you're, I mean, I'm one of those people now. You know what I mean? Because I know. I'm like, get through the first initial weirdness where you're like, wow, I'm hanging out in church basements and I'm drinking soda out of red cups and I'm playing ping pong. You know, it was really weird at first. I was really out of my element. I felt like I had entered like this turbo nerd fest or something. I was back living with my parents in their attic. On allowance again, had lost my career, lost my place of living, you know. I mean, I had nothing going on, and still I found a way to squeeze in the negativity, you know what I'm saying, and the judgment. Like, But again, there was an energy here that I couldn't ignore. And it was the first time when I saw you guys looking as you did, it attracted me enough to get me to sit down and listen to the meetings. I don't think I'd ever listened in the meetings before. Because when I did, again, everyone who got up here, there was some little piece of it where I was like, yeah, me too. Yeah, me too. That language of the heart. I felt like that. You get it. Oh, my God. You get it. And I'm not talking about, like, the particulars, like, oh, well, I didn't go to college and you did. I'm talking about the inside stuff, the way I felt. No one had ever, like, seemed to get the way I felt. And every person after person after person, maybe their particulars were different or whatever, they got it. And I literally knew, like, my people, I'm home. This is it. I finally, 23 years in a life, found the problem and my people, others just like me. And I had given up hope on that. I was seconds and inches from taking my life. My parents had bought a new white cabinet with a lock to lock up everything sharp. They knew. And you guys were so aggressive. You demanded I got a sponsor, which I did, because I just wanted you to stop asking me. And that's plenty good enough reason. I started listening in the meetings, noticing the signs with the 12 steps on them, hearing people say, well, I've got a sponsor, you've got to get a sponsor, I got a sponsor, and I started saying yes to Alcoholics Anonymous my entire life. And I have gone through periods of really being off the beam. And the book says we often find ourselves far off the beams. We are problem people. I am still a problem person. I still have the same sick, perversely negative brain. But ever since this sobriety date, being sponsored, and that sponsor has just started hustling me through the steps. Ever since then, even when it's been really ungraceful, I have not come across anything that has made me feel like I had to drink again. And it is a conviction of mine now today that I know I will never be too sick for the actions of the 12 steps. Whatever comes my way, there's a right step, and more importantly, a right action. And me and my sponsor and God together, that triangle, we can get through anything. And I don't mean to sound Pollyannish either, because I have messed up big time here. I've gotten severely off the beam in sobriety. I've suffered character defects at depth. I had to be hospitalized again in 2007. I let my actions get so far off the beam with my eating, actually. I have suffered resentment at depth where I was certain I would have to leave my home group and get another sponsor. You know, those are two things which I didn't think I was going to make it. But I did, because at the end of the day, and Clancy says this, it's like, I feel like it's kind of like sobriety in a nutshell for me. He says, the people who stay sober are the people who take actions they don't believe in. And at the end of the day, and I've gotten myself to the point where I've been lusting for a drink. Certain everyone I love and care about is against me. Feeling completely alone and wanting to bail out. But at the end of the day, I have gone back to correct action. And by that I mean the instructions of the Big Book. Using the right prayers, taking the right actions, taking responsibility for what I've done and moving forward. At the end of the day, I have gotten through every devastation that I have created for myself in sobriety. And again, that's with me, my sponsor, and God. And I've taken it to the edge, seriously, really bad. But I am grateful for everything that's happened to me in sobriety today, because I have a really good faith. It's hard won. You know, I have major experiences, major mess-ups, but you can't argue with me that I know for myself there is a higher power who is guiding me, for sure, and that the actions of the steps really do work. When Chuck was talking about his mom, that was one thing that came to mind for me too, because I just had so much hate inside. I hated myself so much. I literally felt like a dressed-up trash can. I can't explain to you how deep that hate went, you know. And when you have so much hate in you, it's like if you squeeze a tube of toothpaste comes out. That's how I was when I got here. I mean, full of hate, full of negativity, quick to resent, quick to judge, you know, quick to envy. And my entire life, I had come to blame my mom and hate my mom. I would even just think about her, and literally my temperature would rise. Like, I would get physically hot with that hate. That's how bad it was. And funny, it's like the amends process for me, I know today, will never end. Because I did do an amends early in sobriety. I did, you know, I had a scary sponsor too. Thank God. You know what I'm saying? Like, I was way scared over here in dealing with my sponsor, and way scared of drinking again. So it like perfectly froze me into a good state of willingness to keep going. And I did an early amends with my mom, and I could see the benefits of that. We'd stopped yelling. We got along okay, you know, no screaming. I hadn't gotten physical with her in many years, and I thought that was as good as it was going to get. Then maybe 4 years into sobriety, there was a Thanksgiving we were all hanging out together. And it's just me and my parents. That's it. And there was this one split second where God let me see I had so much more work to do. In 1 second, I was cuddled up on the couch with my dad, and my mom was like all the way across the room in a chair just looking at us, like with sad eyes. I know that God let me see that moment, because I wouldn't have even noticed something like that. And it was another huge pile of bricks moment for me. And I didn't quite know what was going on there, but I did go home to my sponsor, and I was like, something major happened. Something's majorly not right, and I don't really know what it was, but it was enough to get us going. And it was enough for us to talk through. You still have a huge, hardcore, untreated resentment with your mom, and you're never going to have true harmony there until you treat that properly. And so I went through, and I did a whole nother A-step, and that writing was shocking to me. And that process of looking at my part has literally saved my life. It is my nature to put a napkin over my head and just not respond. And the nature of taking inventory or writing out my part and leaving out the other man's part entirely, as the A-step says to do, it forces me to grow up. It forces me to take responsibility for what I've done and make a change. And I saw some stuff there, and God's done that for me too. He has literally allowed me a changed perception. He's allowed me to see my part in a way I could have never done before without his help. And I saw the way I lived over the years and how I played my mom and dad against each other and treated my mom hatefully like she was a sibling, you know. And I set about with a new determination to right that relationship and made another amends. And when the time was right, and she looked at me and said something similar, she said, I still don't know what you do over there. She said, but I want you to thank that sponsor of yours. You've just become such a nicer person. And so that was a couple years ago, and I had a baby like a year, 11 months ago, and you know, she was in the room for that, and she told me that was the best day of her entire life when my son was born. And it's funny, we actually just got back. It was my birthday in February, and she called me, and she said, I have an idea of your birthday. And usually, like, you know, she, like, will, like, handmade me a card. You know what I mean? Like, and I was like, oh, I was like, cool. You know, she's like, I want to take us to Florida for the weekend. And I was like, what? I was like, okay. I mean, I just got back from a trip with my mom to Florida for like 4 days, just me and her. And we had the best time, you know. And that never would have happened if step eight hadn't forced me to truly, deeply examine my part and make it right and make the changes needed to not repeat that same behavior. And honestly, that's also what saved my life when I got so resentful at my sponsor a couple years ago. That resentment was so deep and so justified, and it had spread to the others who are closest to me. And my trusted friend, Bridget, who is my sponsor now, my sponsor actually passed away, at the time, she said, you need to read the four-step like your life depends on it and do what it says. And at the time, again, I was so insulted. Like, this is so much deeper than that. I've been here a while now. You don't think I know what the four-step says? This is not right. I am right. I know we say that a lot, but what's happening is not right. You know that. And she just repeated what she said. And thank God we have true friendships here. She wasn't worried about my feelings. She wasn't like, you're right. It is really messed up. I'd be drunk or dead if she said that to me. She just repeated what she said before. Go home and read every single word of that four step and do what it says, and we'll talk then. And I think about that today in my friendships. You know, I'm going to be honest. I'm going to be kind, but we've got to be honest with each other. Sometimes we're the only thing left between us and a drink. And I went home that night, and I waited for it to be quiet, and I read that four step. And it occurred to me, I didn't remember the last time I had actually stopped to read the little columns on that one page. You know, Mrs. Brown, resentful at her, you know, she wants the house in her name, da 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 da. She snubbed me. I usually skipped over that part. And I read it, and I noticed something in that columns that I'd never noticed before that basically summed up the entire nutshell of my part, and it cracked me wide open. And no, the other person's part didn't change. And like I can tell you honestly and neutrally today, yes, there was the other person was wrong in some respects. But after I'd done that and I'd prayed about it for a couple of days, I completely and very clearly saw my very bad part in the situation and was able to change all of my actions. And it actually made the circumstances more uncomfortable when I did change my actions to be principled again. It made it horribly uncomfortable, but I could tell my stomach, and that's a good barometer for me today, I could tell I was safe again. Like, I was scared when I asked Bridget, what's happening here? I'm so angry. I can't make this. And before I sat down to write out my part, I did have the intuition to wait a day or two to pray for clarity, because I knew if I had sat down right away to just start writing, I knew I wouldn't be able to see anything. So I prayed rigorously for about 2 days, God, please grant me clarity. Please grant me clarity. And he really did. And when I wrote that down, I was shocked and I was embarrassed. And I had to go make some very difficult amends, one of whom to a woman I sponsor, who's one of my closest friends today. I had to change some major things. I had basically, over self-centered fear, gotten slowly off the beam and with some of our principles. And I had to clean up some major damage and made things very uncomfortable in a certain way. But I knew immediately when I saw my part there, I was safe again and I wasn't going to have to drink. And, you know, I hope that kind of explains a little bit of my experience with the steps. I mean, when I say they saved my life, it's not just like a one-time thing like, oh, I got here, I'm sober, you're my people. But day in and day out, these steps and the actions of the steps help me combat my defects, which are still threatening to take me out of here all the time. And I really am so grateful to be sober. It is not my natural state. salivating, drinking dreams, all of that. I still have it constantly. But I was actually telling my sponsor the other day, I would rather have it that way than be struggling to wonder, am I really alcoholic? Like, I know I am. I'm reminded of it often, and I'm okay with that because I did come here under the lash of alcoholism, and it makes it easier for me to keep doing this stuff, which I don't want to do. And that's the other thing I want to say. I'm 10 years sober, but many of the days, I still don't want to, you know? The way that we're asked to live, you know, giving time and energy to helping other alcoholics, caring about prayer and meditation, making restitution for harms done, helping others, remaining entirely honest with somebody, especially someone who I really want to look good to, it's not fun. It's quite awkward. I downright plainly hate it a lot of the time. I mean, it's completely uncomfortable. But I really try my best not to waver from those right actions. And I try today to, I can tell in my stomach when I'm off, you know. And I know that those actions, as listed in the first part of the big book, you know, every life event can go to a certain step which has certain actions. I know for sure if I just get my feet moving right, that I can be brought back to safety again. And this is a design that really does work here, if you're wondering. It really does. And if you're wondering if you're an alcoholic, the sentence in We Agnostics, there's this first paragraph. And I was really fried when I got here, and I could barely read. But I remember coming across that sentence and being like, oh, wow, why didn't someone just explain it to me like this? It's so easy. It says, if you can't control the amount of alcohol you take, or when you try to quit, you can't quit entirely, you are probably an alcoholic. And I was like, that's so much easier than, like, I've seen people in white coats with, like, bad movies made in the 70s, bell charts. I've sat in many circles trying to rate my feelings 1 to 10. But that sentence is like, oh, yeah, I couldn't control the amount of liquor I took, and when I tried to quit, I couldn't quit entirely. I'm an alcoholic. That's it, you know? So I hope that maybe clarifies it. I like that sentence a lot. Makes things really easy. But I am really glad to be here, and thank you so much for having us.